Today is Wednesday. It's March 30th, 2022. It's 2:36 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of the new show On the Block with Block Club Chicago on CW26 and WCIU.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the non-clairvoyant editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter and the occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
Non-clairvoyant?
Anyone? Yeah, last week I said Michigan was going to beat Villanova.
I was clearly
wrong about that. So I don't put any stock in my prediction that Kansas is going to win the national basketball championship.
Oh yeah, this is Duke's year, man. This is Duke's year.
Oh boy, I hope so. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see Coach K get some sort of attention and everybody pat him on the back?
The underdog.
Yeah. St. Peter's was fun. God bless you, St. Peter's. I made the bold prediction that in the next 4 years, a 15 or a 16 will make it to the Final Four. And I'm thinking about amending that to 3 years. Brandon, you think there's some wisdom in that?
I think so. Absolutely. Wow. That's a great take, John. Maybe sooner. It might be next year. The way this year shook out, St. Peter's could have gone all the way. Who knows?
My attitude is a low-seeded team only needs to have a few really good games, and a highly-seeded team only needs to have a mediocre game. The distance between a 15 and a 2 anymore isn't that great that a couple of teams need to have consecutive off nights, and you're in the Final Four, and St. Peter's about proved that this year.
And the talent gap, it really doesn't matter as much anymore either.
Yeah.
Just about how tough you play, and we're seeing that across the board. The teams that are the most stacked with five stars, that's not a lock to get you anywhere. You can be bounced in the first round, have a bunch of NBA talent.
You guys are such Pollyanna. St. Peter got very lucky in the first two rounds. They were pantsed by North Carolina because they just weren't nearly as good, and they weren't going to make it to the final
four. North Carolina didn't have that other thing I said. You need a good team to have a not good night, and the low seed to have another good night, and you only need those things to coincide four games.
Not going to happen, John.
Not going to happen. In 3 years. Okay, you just wait. We're going to continue to do this podcast for three more years just so I can do a little end zone dance. And by the way, before we get rolling on a few topics, and including a guest today, Brandon, what did you say you are now? How did you slate yourself?
I'm the host of a new show with Block Club Chicago and WCIU and CW26 called On the Block. Really excited to do some long-form storytelling and take the power of their neighborhood storytelling to TV.
Every night, once a week, how are we going to see it?
It's going to be weekly, Thursday, 7 o'clock on CW26 and the U, and then it'll re-air on Saturdays and Sundays, I believe, at noon.
Congrats to you, my friend. You still going to have time for the Rascals?
Yeah. I still got time for y'all always. I'll make time because, I mean, the pay, who could turn down that pay bump, man?
For the record, shy of a sponsor, the Rascals work gratis.
I love it, though. You guys are awesome.
So tell your friends, we are making an effort. The only upside for us is that it helps Channel 11, or it helps Brandon, or it helps the Picayune Sentinel. So tell your friends to listen to the Mincing Rascals. The topic that captured America this week has been the slap. I know there's a war and maybe a recession, but Will Smith hit Chris Rock at the Oscars after Rock made a joke about Jada Pinkett Smith's lack of hair. With a few notable exceptions, the world has turned on Will Smith. Even Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote about what a bad message Smith's slap sent. He was really good. Jabbar wrote, "Smith's slap was also a slap to women. By hitting Rock, he announced that his wife was incapable of defending herself against words. From everything I've seen and heard," Jabbar said, "she's very capable and tough and a smart woman." You know, my first reaction, guys, other than, holy crap, my TV audio has gone out, was that you should not make fun of a woman's medical condition. Since then, I've heard that she discusses everything, including that. And secondly, the idea that your reaction to entertainment you don't like is violence can never be acceptable. Now, Brandon, were you watching live when this all went down?
I was watching live and thinking the same thing you were. I thought my internet dropped. I thought something was going wrong with ABC. Then I go online and I see what I thought I saw.
Right.
And that's the slap heard around the world, that loud slap. Initial reaction was just pure hilarity. I thought this was a hilarious situation. I mean, we've never seen anything like this on TV. So what a moment we're going to be talking about for years. But also what a tragedy, because it outshined and overshadowed some really great moments at that Oscars. Summer of Soul, one of my favorite documentaries, got a chance to win an Academy Award right after. And we still, the focus was, oh, what's Will Smith going to say if he wins? Is he going to win Best Actor? What's going to happen here? Coda had an amazing run with some amazing awards. This is a film that has some of the first deaf representation and some of the most amazing in film. We saw some Oscar wins and nominations that are on historic levels. That got overshadowed because of the slap heard around the world. And I think when you listen to what Will Smith's speech, how emotional he was, I don't think he was apologetic at all to Chris Rock, but I do think he was apologetic and felt bad for the moment and the disruption that it caused and how it overshadowed the nominees of the night. So that was my immediate takeaway.
I have to say that I had sort of two different reactions. But initially, I saw the slap and my reaction was, yes, I love mess. Bring it on. I love sort of, you know, like those like live TV moments.
I know what I'm talking about tomorrow. There's a topic, yeah. Bing.
And then Will Smith won the Oscar and it sort of like curdled in my stomach because he said, love makes you do crazy things. Yeah, and like, if you did not see a red flag waving, it's because you have not been a victim of domestic violence, or you do not know people who have been victims to domestic violence, because that is just straight up textbook abuser passing the buck. I'm not saying that Will Smith is a domestic abuser or anything along those lines. I'm just saying that we consistently hear people who are guilty of domestic abuse saying that they just snapped and they went crazy and they just felt so much love and emotion at that moment that they were unable to control their actions. It was honestly traumatizing for a lot of people.
And it's so patronizing. I mean, that was one of my thoughts. I'm like, if this is Planet 12 now, but if that was me and Brenda, she would be like, sit down. You're embarrassing us even more. Like, if you think that cut hurt us or hurt me, you going up there and really shining the megawatt light on me and my alopecia, dude, that's not going to fix this. Although their son tweeted out the next day, this is what we do. Don't mess with us, man. Are you going to get some of that?
Well, John, isn't this sort of part of the problem we're seeing in a lot of this violence in the streets, which is that people take being insulted on social media and they just escalate it to violence very quickly. Yeah. And that we haven't learned to use our words. I think if Will Smith had stayed in his seat and just yelled at him, you know, keep my wife's name out of your effing mouth, that would have been more than enough of an incident to pay. When I saw it first, I thought that maybe it was a bit, because Chris Rock like kept his hands behind his back or at his side. So it looked like it was kind of, and also he didn't, if Will Smith had been truly enraged, wouldn't he be thrown a punch or tried to throw him down? Or it was just such a strange moment.
One slap is incredible restraint.
I also think that our brains are kind of broken, because the number of people who tweeted at me that it was obviously a bit, and of course I had fallen for
it. Looked like
it.
A stage punch. It looked like a fake punch.
Yeah. It looked not like a fake punch or a fake slap to me at all.
Really? I thought over his shoulder, I thought that's the angle where you don't have to hit him, but you can pretend that you hit him. And I thought for 30 seconds that this thing was a game.
I just think that our brains are kind of broken because we don't understand that something like that could happen in a setting like that. And I think a lot of people's instincts were to say, that wasn't what I just saw, because what I just saw is really terrible. Brandon's point about it sort of taking all of the oxygen up in the room is well taken. We're not talking about Questlove, who did an amazing feat of recovered history and won an Oscar for the Summer of Soul documentary. We're not talking about Ariana DeBose, who, you know, is the first queer woman of color to win an Oscar. We're not talking about Roy Katzer, who's the first deaf man to win an Oscar. We're not even talking about Apple TV Plus winning an Oscar before Netflix and Amazon Prime, which is just a great pettiness that I love and adore.
You were really here for the drama, aren't you?
I am. Yes, are. That is my brand.
You know what's been tough?
This thing that went viral by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a lot of us, or some of us certainly have known over the last decade or so, that Jabbar is brilliant. He's a brilliant writer, brilliant analyst. And I bet half the people who saw that went, wait a minute, that old basketball star? And you read it. I mean, and this guy's a great social commentator. He's got a terrific Substack. And it's kind of nice that he got this real burst of attention and that people are going to realize that he is right up there with the great pundits of America. It's nice to see that anyway.
I'll rain on his parade a little bit.
Uh-oh.
It's been interesting to see how this has all played out through cultural lenses and through racial lenses. Within the Black community itself, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's column is not popular. It's seen as patronizing, and for many seen as, he makes the argument that it perpetuates stereotypes of Black men being aggressive. And doesn't send a good example of Black America. And I think the reaction from a lot of like people my age and other Black people is that, why are we worried about putting on a good show or a good face for white people? Like, why does that got to be something that's always in our head? If any racist was watching that, Will Smith slapping Chris Rock wasn't what changed their mind about whether they're going to support Black people or not. So that angle and that kind of area of the analysis from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has been getting ridiculed online from a lot of Black people, at least. And that's been part of the interesting part of this whole discussion, is just how people view it through cultural lenses as well. I mean, I saw it as a family dispute that aired out in public and that should have not aired out in public. And I think Diddy got up afterward and he said something like, you know, hey, we're all going to laugh about it, get together at the Jay-Z gold party, and it's all going to be good. People are talking about Chris Rock pressing charges. We all knew, at least us in the Black community, that's not going to happen because those dudes just had a public disagreement. There is a conversation to be had about how do we, you know, express ourselves, right, positively and not resorting to violence right away. But that was just a moment of raw honesty. And the tough thing for me, it's tough to give a straight Black or white analysis and not to be somewhere in the middle, because we don't know all the facts. We don't know Chris Rock and Will Smith's relationship exactly. We don't know if Chris Rock knew that Jada Pinkett Smith had alopecia. We don't know if they had a discussion about this and Chris Rock just said, I'm just going to ignore it anyway. Like, there's a lot of context there that we as just viewers aren't aware of. That doesn't make Will Smith slapping Chris Rock okay. But then when you add in the things Will Smith has gone through with the Tupac situation with Jada Pinkett Smith, she used to date Tupac and has always mentioned him and has publicly kind of questioned Will Smith's manhood. Then you bring in what he's talked about in his book about how his father abused his mother and he always regrets the fact that he couldn't defend her and fight for her. So this whole idea of fighting for family, like all of that stuff packed in, and then the Regina Hall joke beforehand about their relationship, I'm sure it all boiled up into that moment. There's a lot of context there, and I feel like it's deeper than just a joke for Will Smith and Chris Rock. And so that's why it's tough for me to give a definitive, you know, yay, nay. In the end, it shouldn't have happened in public. It should have happened at the after party.
Well, could you give us a definitive yay or nay on that, Brandon? Oh, wait, said you can't do that.
I would just add that it's possible to hold two thoughts in your head at the same time, that Chris Rock should not have made fun of any woman's hair, much less a Black woman's hair. And he shouldn't have done it at the Oscars, where everybody's watching and it just wasn't the right time. And it was a dusty joke.
That's the thing. G.I. Jane, really?
Wow. Like, I had to explain that to like five millennials. Yeah. They were like, Heather, help me out. You are old.
I got an email from a listener who said, as a hairdresser, I was doing the hair of a woman who had cancer, and she said that the diagnosis for cancer was not as jarring to her as the loss of the hair.
Absolutely.
And Chris Rock actually did a documentary about black women's hair. I mean, he appreciates what that means to them. I do wonder if he knew that she had alopecia or not. But at the end of the day, Brandon, you do a nice job of laying out maybe the context we don't appreciate. But I hope you would say, but you still, I mean, just, it's not hard to say you shouldn't hit the guy, right? You
right.
can say
That's
that.
That's the second plot. He shouldn't have made the joke. Will Smith shouldn't have hauled off and slapped him.
Are you with
not
us?
At the Oscars.
Know, full stop.
Not at the Oscars. Okay.
I'm not a violence is not the answer guy. I'm a violence shouldn't be the answer, but sometimes it needs to be. So I'm like, but not publicly at the Oscars in front of everybody. Like, run up on him after the show. Do it old school like in the 90s. Like, don't do it in public on TV. That's my controversial take.
There's a book called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. It's written by Ray Long, who co-authored a very long piece in the Tribune, a very good piece in Sunday's Tribune about Mike Madigan. And we asked him to join us today to not only sort of reset the stage, but tell us where this case is going. Ray, thanks for joining the Mincing Rascals. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Really well done piece in Sunday's paper.
Well, thanks. What we wanted to do there is explain in depth what was going on. And basically, it comes down to this. Mike Madigan was publicly pushing for his daughter to get a pro-consumer bill through for low-energy folks to get some extra help in paying their bills. And he also, on the side, was pushing for a couple of his cronies to get jobs at ComEd. When it came down to it, he got the jobs and her bill got killed. And so we walked through how that went down in the back rooms.
Is it possible that Mike Madigan thought that this, a la Rod Blagojevich, is how the soup gets made? Or did he know that this is ethically shady, maybe, but not illegal? Did he know? Do you think he knew this is breaking the law?
He's done so many of these kind of things where he can parse different pieces. I'm not sure if he viewed it one way or another. He thinks that he never crosses the line, and he's drawn the lines over the years, especially at the state level. But he probably viewed these things as different transactions and not being, you know, together, because indictment doesn't actually say it was a trade, but it sets it up in a way that makes it look like it could have been, I'll kill the legislation if you give me these two jobs. Now, that is a really cold transaction, if that's what it was. And he clearly was trying to push Juan Ochoa into a board of directors seat for ComEd, a regulated, state-regulated entity. And that alone is one of questionable conflict of interest, at least. But then he also wants to put his neighboring retired alderman, Mike Zalewski, of the 23rd Ward on the southwest side, into a job that really doesn't require a whole lot of heavy lifting, if any lifting at all.
There's not a lot in this for Madigan. I mean, you know, we already suspected this. Now we're going to have proof that the guy was a crook. Is he going to go to jail? Where was the reward for the risk? It just doesn't seem to be worth it. You're not getting $1 million. He's getting a $5,000 a month thing for one guy, and the other guy's going to get a nice situation, and some folks are going to get internships. You're going down for that.
So I was talking to my neighbor at the school bus stop this morning about how she asked whether I thought, on a totally different topic, whether they were finally going to bring charges against former President Trump. And I said, I don't know, but I can tell you that federal prosecutors don't tell us what they do and that we don't know what we don't know. And I know I've said that before on this show, but up until the day Madigan was indicted, we had all sort of wondered whether they just hadn't managed to find the evidence against him. And I think that's sort of where we still are, because I know Ray and I have talked a little bit about this, that the indictment itself did not have a whole lot of new information in it. Like, it sort of filled out the gaps on sort of what we had sort of known and had been reported in the Tribune, the Sun-Times, and WBEZ and other places, but that we're not quite clear sort of what changed between we can't indict him and we have indicted him.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by this relationship between the Speaker and the Attorney General, the Madigans.
His daughter.
Early on, of course, Speaker Madigan essentially installed his daughter as Attorney General. She was a backbencher in the legislature, and he promoted her candidacy and got her elected over John Schmidt, who was a career high-profile Washington lawyer, and everyone thought that he had such experience that he was going to win. And she did a good job, I think, for four terms. And things seemed to sour between them when she said in 2013 she wasn't going to run for governor because he wouldn't step aside. And then she just resigned abruptly, it seemed to me. It surprised a lot of us when she left. And then this was in 2018, I think, she announced she wasn't going to run again. Or was it 17? Anyway, but it was a surprise, and it made me wonder whether some of this plays into the fact that the Speaker did not seem to, not only did he not help her legislation, this was supposed to be, as Ray's story put it, was her last hurrah, right, Ray? I mean, it was
she was in her last year as Attorney General at the end of four terms, 16 years.
And this was a real consumer friendly bill, and it was designed to help low income people get reconnected in a sense. And the Speaker torpedoed it for reasons that are, I mean, clearly Conrad was against it, but he sort of had to choose at that point, was he going to help his daughter? Is he going to help his buddies? And he helped his buddies. And did that surprise you? I mean, you've done his whole history in your new book. Is that consistent with him and his?
Well, you know, it's consistent with the idea that he didn't want to step down so that she could have a clear path to the governorship. She believed, as she said, when she decided not to run, that she would not run for governor because if she won, no family should have that much power to be the governor and the Speaker of the House. Madigan, the Speaker, and a couple weeks later, when we finally caught up with him, said she knew all along, you know, this wasn't any surprise to her, but she knew. He emphasized that in his way to
she knew
draw
what?
Out words.
She knew what?
She
right?
knew that he wasn't going to step down. Mm-hmm. And she had been raising money at a pace that made it look like she was going to get into the game, but she eventually pulled the plug on it.
She could have done more damage to his career as the Attorney General, right? I mean, that's awkward enough, isn't it?
The Attorney General doesn't have all the ability to dip into all the things they should be able to dip into. And I'm sure it was set up in the Constitution so that the Attorney General wouldn't be this big watchdog over state government.
If he's found guilty, does he go to jail? How long does he go to jail for if he does?
Depends on what he's guilty of. Depends on if he pleads. Depends on if he goes to trial and fights it all the way.
Well, Ray, he's guilty of everything. Don't you know?
Okay. Okay, well, you know, you've been around him a lot more than me, obviously. So I have not.
Nobody has. How many interviews have you done with him? Because we did this on, I mean, you're looking at Heather Cerrone and Ray Long and Eric Zorn. Brandon, I don't know if your job over the years has maybe given you enough occasion to logically have interviewed the Speaker of the House, but I have been, and I've interviewed him once. How many times have you interviewed him, Ray?
Yeah, it's less than a handful. And it's been a long time since that. He did not interview for the book. I gave him a chance to, but he didn't take me up on it, obviously. But it's not like he hasn't been accessible to people who were covering him in Springfield. A lot of times he wasn't. A lot of times he would, you know, give you a snippy answer and spin on his heel and go on, or walk right on by, no matter if you're asking him questions or not. Or sometimes he'd stop for 5 or 10 or 20 minutes, you know, and answer questions. Sometimes he'd be too vague because he was intentionally too vague. Sometimes he was intentionally specific because he wanted to be. So the book is not, for example, short on quotes, because he's been around so long and I've covered him for so long. And there's so many people who have interviewed him over the years that I was able to tap into a lot of that.
I kind of want to get a sense from you, though, just in context, kind of like the scope of this, right? Like when we talk about Michael Madigan, big buzzworthy name here in Illinois, but I can't think of anything outside of Illinois, any figure outside of Illinois that's in local politics that has had this much of a political career and the way it's all shaken out with the, yeah, you know, alleged corruption and stuff. Can you kind of give a sense of the scope of from your perspective what that's like?
Yeah, I mean, nationally, of course, there was Sheldon Silver, who went down in New York. He was the Speaker of the House there. But the deal is that Madigan is unique in so many different ways. He didn't, you know, he was a Sphinx-like character in some ways, and he also controlled every lever of politics and government, and he would use legislation to further the politics, and he would use politics to further the legislation. He was able to figure out ways to get something to tilt things toward Democrats or to tilt things to keep himself in power all the time. And the other kind of weird thing about it was that he didn't really seek the national spotlight. Like, say, Mayor Daley was a mover and shaker at the national level. Mike Madigan didn't even attend all the Democratic National Committee meetings, you know, and it wasn't like high on his agenda. His agenda was keep the speakership and build on it.
Was it your sense, Ray, that he doesn't have a really strong political ideology, that his main motivation was keeping power? And I mean, he shifted on abortion. He shifted on, I believe, on some gay rights issues, maybe on the death penalty. Was his weather vane always just pointing in the direction of where the power is coming from?
Well, I don't know if it was always, but he was surely flexible. He was, and you know, he's a Southwest Side guy. He came out of an Irish enclave on the Southwest Side. He had conservative social values. He changed on many issues over the years. Abortion is one of them, where he had gone from a more conservative position to expanding abortion rights. The issue of gay marriage is another one that we saw. But you also saw him, a really good example was when the concealed carry came up before the legislature. A federal court said we have to have concealed carry in Illinois. He had opposed that for years and years and years, and yet he realized it had to be done. And they, you know, the two sides in Springfield could not get it together, but they went to Madigan, or Madigan drew them into his room. He listened as they all went through all their issues, and then they forged something together. And I did do some interviews on that, because I thought that showed how he could be flexible. And when he got up on the floor, he said, a lot of you are going to wonder why I'm taking this position, because I've been against concealed carry over the years, but here's why. And he went through the reasons, and he showed that he could be a leader when he had to be.
It's not a bad thing, what you just described. Maybe that's the way more legislators should be, right?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when you get these kinds of districts that are set up through massive gerrymandering, you end up with the far right or far left arguing it out in the primary. And then you end up with one of those candidates as the representative of your district. And so you don't always hear that great middle ground.
Why do people keep reelecting this guy? You know, isn't it kind of weird that for 40 years we all know that we're kind of being cheated? I don't know, finish that sentence with whatever verb you like. But then somebody sent me a note and they go, hey, listen, my grandma, my mom lives in his district. And when you call, stuff gets done. very good retail politics. But isn't it kind of sad that all these years we all knew this guy was probably hoodwinking somebody for something, and then nothing we could do about it. Nothing we could do about it.
He certainly had an incredible and still has an incredible ward organization. He had stressed over the years to all of the rank and file lawmakers that the way to really stay in office is by having great service to your district. You know, a lot of people don't care how you vote on different issues down here. There's only a few hot button ones every year, but they'll know whether or not you responded when you said you needed something fixed in your driveway or something like that.
It's how Chicago aldermen operate, right?
Yeah,
you call in and your trash bin needs to be replaced, and they replace it. Or your street light in your alley is out.
Right.
They replace it, and you go, "I'll vote for him. Or
right.
I'll vote for her." Yeah. When they're talking about policy, a lot of the stuff that goes on in Springfield just goes right by people. I mean, for instance, just to get back to this great story that Ray was co-author on Sunday, this bill that was advancing, I don't even remember reading that much about it at the
mm-hmm.
time.
Right.
It was a question of rate relief, and ComEd was saying, "Oh, if you do this for poor people, then we're going to have to raise rates on everybody, and we're going to have to put in a new structure, a new software," and all. They were complaining, and but it was one of those things that I think most people didn't pay any attention to.
Right.
And so he was able to then you apparently use this, but then again, Ray, you said that I think the story says that Ochoa and Zalewski did not get the positions that they were angling for.
No, they
right?
did get the positions.
They
did get the positions.
They don't have them now, though.
They don't have them now, right.
That's what, okay.
The house that Madigan built, 5-star review I'm reading here, unsparing and authoritative, the page-turning account of one of the most powerful politicians in Illinois history. Ray, I haven't picked up the book yet. That's my next read. Thanks for visiting.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Great seeing you, Ray.
In July of 2020, guys, in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, do I remember this correctly? It was the early months of the pandemic. There was violence in the city. And I don't know what you call those people that gathered at Grant Park at the Columbus statue. Were they vandals or vigilantes or protesters of some sort? They got into combat with the police. They were throwing frozen water bottles at the cops and firecrackers. They had umbrellas to shield themselves from stuff that might come their way, including to shield their identity. The statue was eventually removed from Grant Park and hadn't been heard from much until a couple of weeks ago when we discovered the mayor was upset that it might reappear at the Columbus Day Parade. You remember the exchange of email and how upset she was about that. But now the mayor says that the Columbus statue is probably going to go back to its perch, at least for the time being, at Grant Park. I don't want to make more out of this than is necessary, but I don't think we've heard the end of this either. Should we care about this or what?
So there are two Columbus statues at issue. There's the one that was in Grant Park, and there is the one that was in Arago Park in Little Italy. Now, the statue that was in Little Italy is very, very important to the Italian-American community in Chicago. It was originally part of the Columbian Expedition in 1893. There's a lot of history with this statue, and there is no doubt that the Italian-American Civic Committee wants that statue returned post-haste, and that's the subject of the lawsuit that prompted those allegedly intemperate remarks by the mayor. The Grant Park statue is a different issue. So the Grant Park statue is essentially in the same limbo as the other Columbus statue, but there's just been less activism around that statue, which was why I think a lot of people were a little concerned to hear the mayor say that she was determined to bring it back to Grant Park, even though she has said that all along since it was removed. The mayor has talked a lot about the police officers who were injured in that melee outside the statue, but not spoken about the Chicagoans who were hurt by police during that melee, including an 18-year-old girl, Miracle Boyd, who had several teeth knocked out by a police officer who is now facing termination for his actions during that event. I think that's a very sort of interesting and purposeful framing of what happened at the Columbus statue. A bunch of people were protesting at the statue, and a confrontation between them and the Chicago Police Department erupted, in which several people were injured, including a teenage girl, and an officer is facing termination for what he did.
Then why did they assault the police officers? Why did they have frozen water bottles in them?
No one has ever been charged, to the best of my ability, with assaulting police officers at the Columbus statue, which isn't to say that it didn't happen.
Wait a minute, what am I talking about? The police officers weren't attacked at that scene?
So they certainly were. I'm just saying that I don't think it's accurate to sort of say that this was some sort of event that only featured protester on police violence. It was much more complicated than that.
But I still don't understand what the hell was going on there. It seemed to be very coordinated. It sounds like I'm looking for a fight here, but I'm trying to reset what the hell. And you've got your dukes up, and I will lose this fight, I know, just for the record. Brandon, we're going to settle this with words, just so you know. We're not
no slapping.
But okay, I'm glad you're saying what you're saying, Heather, because here's how I remember it. These hooligans showed up with umbrellas and frozen water bottles. It looked like a scene out of a Batman movie or something. And what did the police do to them? And do those people care about the Columbus statue? And what kind of the hell kind of free speech is this? I know the world was in a lot of turmoil at the time. People's emotions were running high, but I didn't think the police deserved anything that happened. And I'm sorry if you got busted in the chops by that cop. I'm sure some of them misbehaved. But I saw a lot of them just stand there and take the rain of crap from people. I felt really bad for the cops. Okay, I'm done.
Well, there's no doubt that this has become sort of an incident that people point to when they talk about the violence that Chicago police officers face. And it's very, very visceral. And there were officers themselves were injured during this event.
Yeah.
I just think that it matters if we frame this one way or the other. The fact that there's a recommendation that an officer be terminated for his conduct at that event is relevant. While we are months and months overdue to figure out what should happen with this statue, along with other 40 with 40 other monuments that were flagged by the mayor's commission as somehow problematic, I think that's the larger issue.
I do too. I listen. That's why I'm interested in this. Five Abraham Lincoln statues are in the committee's review. Benjamin Franklin, George Washington is under review. Boy, I could make decisions on some of those pretty quickly myself. But Christopher Columbus is an interesting game for that conversation as well.
My question is, why is the mayor sticking her hand in the spokes here on the Columbus statue in Grant Park? That was the scene of all this violence and unrest. She said in her remarks the other day that she was going to have some sort of security plan for this.
Safety
plan. The police in Chicago don't have enough to do. They got to go stand and protect a statue from people.
It's hard to know whether the mayor is actually developing a plan to bring the Columbus statues back to Little Italy and Grant Park, or if she's not willing to sort of move off of where she was in July 2020, which was, we're taking the statues down as a temporary public safety issue, and we will bring them back.
It's just a weird intersection between the Columbus statue and the race issues.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's about the Columbus statue. I never thought it was about the Columbus statue.
Well, John, there have been protests about Columbus around the country for decades.
That's not what that rally was in 2020.
It was specifically, they had ropes and pulleys and they were out there trying to take
I know the that, but I don't think that when they were trying to pull Columbus down that they were upset about the historical review of Christopher Columbus.
That's why they said they were.
I felt it was symbolic.
Well, it was part of the moment, John. There's no question about that, that we were in a different moment than, because there was a lot of street unrest, a lot of attention being paid to white supremacy and the effects of racism and so on. So this was, like I say, part of this moment. Mm-hmm. But I think it was really unwise for the mayor to say that it was temporary, to promise that you bring them back, and now to say again she's going to bring them back. To my mind, with outside of the Italian-American community in Chicago, a fraction of them, this issue was kind of on the back burner. And I don't know why she felt like she needed this issue on top of everything else that she's going to be dealing with.
She was asked about it. She didn't bring it up on her own.
How many times have you covered her a million times? She deflects all the time. We're still looking at that. She's deflecting on the Monuments Commission,
So she said nothing this week that she hasn't said consistently since July 2020.
She said she was personally traumatized by it, though. Brandon, why are you breathing that way?
This is the whole issue with Lightfoot. What is her base? What exactly is she trying to do? How does this serve her to bring this back into the news cycle? Because either way, progressives are going to hate you for bringing this back, right? Just the idea of, oh, it's going to come back, and that doggedness, we're going to bring it back. Like, progressives that voted for you, you're like, why? Why are we? And then on the other side, if you don't bring it back, the fact that it was taken away in the first place, people that were pro it, they're frustrated about that. Make a definitive decision. And I don't think anyone's going to be choosing to vote for Lightfoot or not based off of this alone, but it points to a series of issues where she just doesn't really make a firm stance or deliver on results. She ran on an elected school board. What's happening with elected school board? Now she's against it. Like, there's a series of issues where it's hard to figure out where exactly she really aligns and who exactly her base is. Where is her support? And if I'm her, I got to start looking at pulling Akeisha Lance Bottoms and thinking about doing something else outside mayor, because this just highlights to me one of the issues with her. Where is the support? You're just throwing another bomb in here that blows up everything as far as you trying to rally that.
There's no doubt that Lightfoot feels under pressure from potential challengers in 2023 on the issue of crime.
She is creating a situation where we might see over the summer a replay of this tumult, this unrest, this police violence, this protester violence. She's basically creating a situation, if you put the statue back, where that's going to be front and center, and it could easily go sideways again. So how does that help her on the issue of crime? I don't see that. I just see it as being a distraction.
Why even bring it back? Has anyone noticed it's gone?
I think she's under a lot of pressure from this lawsuit filed by the Italian American Civic Committee. So there's a very real legal question as to whether the city acted properly when they took down the statue in Little Italy. So it may be that this is her sort of signaling and trying to give herself room on this lawsuit and to say, well, look, I haven't ruled anything out. Because if she gets up there and say, look, I'm not putting the statue back in Grant Park, I don't care what happens, that's a legal problem because she's dealing with ongoing litigation.
Yeah.
Brendan Riley, who's the alderman of the 42nd Ward downtown, a lifetime ago proposed renaming Balboa Drive for Ida B. Wells. Now, Balboa was a literal Italian fascist, and that the monument to him was gifted to Chicago by Mussolini, an actual Italian fascist. And the Italian American Civic Committee revolted in anger and ended up blocking that. And that's why Congress Parkway is now Ida B. Wells Drive. And that, to signal how angry they were at him, Brendan Riley had no opposition. They vowed to oust him from the city council. And that forced Brendan Riley to give $100,000 of his own money to his own campaign to scare off anybody from channeling him. So Chicago politicians take the Italian sort of political community in Chicago very, very seriously.
Wasn't there an opportunity, though, for the mayor to say, OK, I'll put the statue back in Little Italy. We'll keep the statue in Grant Park down for now. Some sort of a compromise.
I wonder if she could have done it, or somebody could have put the statue up the same way Meg's Field was dozed. Just quietly do it in the night. Just put it up there. Don't make a hullabaloo about it. Eventually people would notice, right? But let's not make it the target that, like Eric says, we might be making it again. Producer Pete just handed me this. I guess this is NBC reporting here. Democrats are eyeing Chicago as a city of interest to host the party's 2024 convention, and the mayor, the governor, and a key U.S. senator are coordinating on a plan to make that happen, a firm with the potential bid confirmed to NBC News. So the 2024 Democratic National Convention would be in Chicago. All the more reason to tamp down any images of violence in our city, huh, guys?
I am simultaneously very excited and very scared.
Do we want that, Brandon, in our city in 20?
Does Joe Biden want that? That's the question, because the issue of violence is going to become an issue for him. you're in Chicago, it's no doubt going to be talked about nonstop.
Will it be good for the city? Will it be good for Chicago, Eric Zorn?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I covered the 96 convention and it was kind of fun. I still think these political conventions are just basically 4-day TV shows. And I don't think that many people are watching them anymore. I don't think it's as big a deal as it would have been
as it was downtown.
In 96. Yeah, bring a lot of people downtown. Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing. I would say yes, it's a good thing. Speaking of breaking news that Heather has covered today or on Wednesday, we have a new inspector general, or there is going to be a new inspector general. The mayor has finally, after 165 days without one, Heather.
Right. Yeah. So Deborah Witzberg, who was the number two official in the inspector general's office, we expect Lightfoot to name her to the top job tomorrow.
If we get a good inspector general, what do we get that we don't got right now? What does that do for the city or any of us?
The inspector general's role changed significantly as part of the consent decree overseeing the Chicago Police Department. They have a court-mandated role in overseeing how the Chicago Police Department operates. And it should not be lost on anybody that Witzberg's sort of final report as the Deputy Inspector General for Public Safety was an audit that found that Black Chicagoans are disproportionately searched by Chicago police officers and are disproportionately suffer the use of force at the hands of Chicago police officers. So it's those sort of audits and studies that this office is really designed to do. And when you have a mayor appointing an interim watchdog, I think there are clear questions about whether somebody could be independent, especially after Lightfoot told the press after Ferguson's term ended that she wanted an inspector general that, quote, stayed in their lane. And there are going to be a lot of questions about that.
On our campaign 2020 watch, Eric, what are you looking at this week?
Just some of the new commercials that are out there. Darren Bailey has finally hit the air going down. He's targeting all of his ads south of I-80, essentially. And Richard Irvin, the mayor of Aurora, Republican hopeful for governor, has got an ad out saying that he is the Democrats' worst enemy. He says that the Democrats don't like people who look like him. He's Black. But think like us, which I thought was a very strange way of phrasing it. And then he talked about all lives matter, which is sort of a dog whistle phrase. It's been a really interesting week. Also, Heather's station WTTW did a pretty interesting look at deep dive into some contracting issues in Aurora that did not reflect well on Richard Irvin. So we know we're seeing some ground pawing. There was an endorsement by Flynn, the former national security advisor. He endorsed Rabine, I think, right?
Yeah, Michael Flynn.
Which is like, I don't know that that's something that you want to even mention to anybody.
Right. That helps, Hal.
Well, Trump had to pardon Flynn, and so you've got this guy. I don't know. It seems like Rabine may be grasping at straws here, but we're still in the early stages of this gubernatorial primary race. I think it's going to ramp up maybe 6 weeks or so. We're going to really start seeing more activity. But right now, there's a lot of maneuvering for position.
One last thing, then, since you mentioned the former president, there's a 7+ hour gap in the president's phone logs on January 6th. We know that because some of the calls that we know that took place don't appear in the official phone log. So what else was not logged? I don't think we would ever get the content of those calls. Am I right about that, guys? But simply who called whom, how long it lasted, that sort of thing.
Good to know.
I don't know, Brandon. How scandalous is this? Is there fire there?
I think there's a lot of fire because didn't this span literally the entire insurrection?
Kind of, yeah. Oh, yeah, it certainly coincided with everything you saw on TV that day.
So that's the crucial span of time where we want to actually see who was he talking to, right? Like, to me, that's like a glaring red flag, like, hello, hello.
Yeah, but I mean, Brandon, so we'll probably find out he was talking to Sean Hannity. I mean, really, I'll bet if we started to tick off some names, if you had a betting pool, I'll bet it's Sean Hannity. I'll bet it's Rudy Giuliani. I'll bet it's Don Jr., maybe. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care what Don Jr. thinks, but maybe Ivanka. I suspect
maybe
those...
a Josh Hawley. I'm curious what people maybe on the inside he was talking to, too, or any staffers.
Mike Pence. Well, I think we know that Pence was one of the phone calls that took place at that time.
You're forgetting about Hillary Clinton's emails. And I don't know how you can possibly not bring that up at this point.
Where we were so interested in private records of or use of Hillary's phone, lo and behold.
Hunter Biden's laptop, too.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's it. That's it.
I just know that if it was, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot, if this was a Democratic president, right, and the GOP saw this gaping hole, 7 hours, oh, man, you know they would be working it. Operation Warp Speed, Benghazi, Hillary's emails, Hunter Biden's laptop. Like, come on. They would be all over this. So I'm curious what will come of this. I'm not sure the Democrats are going to have that same energy.
They're not going to be able to get it. They're not going to be able to get these logs apparently don't exist or have been deep sixed. So they're not going to get it. So it's all going to be speculation. It's going to fill those gaps. And I'm not sure that redounds well to the president, former president. But again, maybe the logs would have been much worse. So
that's what I'm wondering, too. Does the information exist and it can be retrieved, or does it not exist at all? Other than parsing every single person he could have talked to, seeing if they called him, you could sort of reverse engineer it. But do we know if there is an official White House log of that information?
During the transition, all of those logs and records are supposed to be transferred to the archives. And part of what the January 6th committee has requested from the archives, and that was the subject of a Supreme Court case, was to obtain whether any of these records exist in those records. So as I understand it, the archives has begun producing those records to the January 6th committee, but they are literally thousands and thousands of pieces of paper. So I don't think anybody knows whether those logs were not kept or destroyed or were somehow not transferred properly. It's not just the logs, it's also notes. So when the president speaks with somebody on the phone, there is supposed to be an aide on the phone taking notes, producing a record of what was said by the president and said by the other person, so that the other person can't essentially give a press conference and say, great news, the president just appointed me supreme commander of the United States military, all hail me. You're supposed to have some record to prevent that from happening.
It's conceivable that you would have a conversation between the president and somebody saying, slow walk the police, you know, let's let this thing transpire a little longer so as to put some pressure on Mike Pence or Republicans to delay, if nothing else, the certification. You can imagine him doing something like that. And the legal ramifications for something like that could be extraordinary.
Plausible, too. You got to remember that judging from the way everyone is reading the polls right now, this January 6th commission has until next January to get anything done, because the Republicans seem likely to take over the House. And one of the first things they will do on the first day is disband that committee. Yeah. And we will have no more investigations there. Although we still have at least 2 more years of Attorney General Merrick Garland, right, who could conceivably still be following up on this. So time is wasting here.
We haven't mentioned the fact that a federal judge this week found that it was more likely than not that President Trump had participated in that conspiracy to prevent the vote from being certified on January 6th, because these call logs are potentially evidence of his role in not just the encouragement of the insurrection, but his directing of the scheme that the insurrection was designed to allow to flourish.
Before we go, do you guys want to hear a joke?
No.
Yeah. Yes.
Is it a Will Smith, Chris Rock joke? Because that's the only kind of joke I've been getting sent this week. All right. Go ahead, Brandon.
Here we go. Okay. What did Chris Rock have on his face?
I know the answer to this, but I'm going to let you have it. Going to let you have it.
Here we go. He had Fresh Prince. Oh, gotta love a good dad joke.
On that note.
Boo, tomato.
Brandon, always nice to hear you on the Mincing Rascals. This will be your last visit with us, but it's always been a pleasure.
Brandon, tomatoes off the stage.
Heather Sharon and Eric Zorn were produced by Pete Zimmerman. That wraps it up, campers. Thanks, kids.
Bye, thanks. Y'all.
Bye. That was fun.
It was fun. I'll see you guys later.
Brandon, have you been watching the jokes that the Greek Freak posts? He does jokes like that all the time. Dad jokes.
Does he?
And then he tells the joke, and then he kind of exits off the camera really fast.
What do you call a cow on the floor? Anybody know? Ground beef. That's it.
You're saying I'm a better comedian than an NBA MVP.
Yes,
I
am.
To me. I'm going to cherish that. Thank
you. That's a low bar, but you go ahead and enjoy that, my friend.
I'm going to tuck it right here. Thank you.
Congrats on that gig, man. What's the first day? What's the first day that the show is on?
It airs April 14th. That's the first day. So we'll see what happens.
Okay,
but yeah, April 14th. That's the day. Thanks a lot, bro.
All right, see you around.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.